During the 1960s and 70s, Bel Air's boyish and engaging face stared out from wanted posters. A son of privilege who chose to go underground, changing his name, his appearance, where he worked and slept every few months. He took odd jobs, shoplifted, stole explosives, and set off bombs, all, he said, for peace, to shut down America's war in Vietnam. Bel Air was a wanted man and a weatherman, a member of the Radical Weather Underground. Mr. Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, came above ground in 1981. Most of the charges against them for mob action and assault were dismissed. They now have three children. They go to Little League games and are well-known legal and educational activists in Chicago. Their personal story has essentially been borrowed as the premise for a few movies and TV shows. They have always resisted telling much themselves about what they did during their decade underground. But now, Bel Air has written a kind of memoir, Fugitive Days, and he joins us from our bureau in Chicago. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
And yet you say at the beginning it's important to you that this is not a tell-all in that sense.
No, I don't think it's a tell-all. I also don't think it's a manifesto or a history. It really is an attempt to work with memory and to try to bring back something of the resonant feeling of those times, choices made, and to give some sense of an older person commenting on those times.
What do you think, looking back on, made you not a liberal but a radical?
I think more than anything, it was coming out of a very privileged and really happy childhood and waking up and looking around and seeing a world in flames. And I was moved to identify with the people who were the victims of this system more than abstractly. I became very personally identified with the people who were resisting the American power abroad, people who were resisting American racism at home. And the more involved I got, the more I felt called to become more involved.
Could I ask you for a reading? This is a section where you describe the movement. Boy, that's a phrase to be careful with. We're talking about a more than vaguely left-wing political movement that was aligned in its opposition to the war in Vietnam and in favor of what we used to identify as civil rights policies. Is that a pedantic but fairly accurate description?
I think that's pretty accurate. And the part that I'll read is from the mid-60s, when Students for a Democratic Society was the leading student organization, and I was a member of it, as you noted. People floated into the movement now for 1,000 reasons. Resistance to the war and the draft, certainly, to the gathering torment, and in opposition as well to segregation and racism, the lengthening American nightmare. People joined for love, too, because liberation was in the air and the idea of freedom was in full blood, breaking banks and borders, cascading into new channels and forks, and surprising possibilities as it rolled along. Everything was on the agenda now: justice and peace, education and culture and spirituality, work, sexuality, gender, art. The old gods failed, and the old truths left the world, and we asked, how shall I live? What is this thing called living? I wanted to become a new man and to dance or to march, or both, with others toward a brighter future, an expanding sense of humanity.
I can remember when people would say, you know, half the people in the movement are just there for the girls or the boys. You don't necessarily deny that. I don't think you put the percentage half on it, but you say people had profoundly personal reasons, and at that age, that's not a bad one.
Well, you know, I think that, I guess I have two responses. One is, I think that none of us are fully conscious of our motives, and so who knows why people joined? For a lot of personal reasons, for selfish reasons, for grandiose reasons, perhaps. But the one thing that has to be noted is that we joined to end the war, and we joined to fight racism. Without understanding that context, you can't really understand the motives of that generation.
Well, explain it to us now, if you can. How did, for example, setting off a bomb in the woman's room, a woman's room in the Pentagon, how did that help shut down the war in Vietnam?
Well, it's hard for me to know exactly all the things that went into helping end the war. I think the Vietnamese people themselves take the major credit. And I think everything from the bombing of the Pentagon to young men running away to Canada and Sweden helped. I think desertion helped. I think a lot of things helped. So I'm not sure I would make a great claim. Mm-hmm. But our thinking at the time was that we had to attack symbolically the places of American power. And we had to show that what seemed impenetrable and impossible to oppose could be opposed militantly, radically, by people right here in America. And in a sense, again, it's that identification with the Vietnamese that led some of us to say, well, since we're dropping tons and tons and tons of bombs, the United States, on Vietnam, and they have no capacity to even fire back, here we are, behind enemy lines, so to speak. And we felt it was our duty to do anything we could. And so that was the kind of thinking that led to it.
I have to ask, you or somebody called the Pentagon, what was it, half an hour before the bomb was scheduled to go off?
Something like that.
And said there's a bomb somewhere. It got pretty specific, I gather. Did you consider the idea that somebody who was there making cheese sandwiches for the cafeteria might have gone in to use the bathroom and could have died in your action?
I think that we were conscious of the risks that this put people at, and we felt seriously concerned, worried, and conscious of it. And that doesn't justify, you know, the risk that we were creating for people. But we did take it very seriously, and in retrospect, we didn't actually hurt anybody. So we figured out ways to be careful. On the other hand, as you know from reading the book, it's not in any way a defense or a blueprint for that kind of activity. It's simply a description of, again, how one person at a time of crisis made these decisions.
Interesting you use the word blueprint. Was it on your mind to avoid a blueprint?
Very much so. For a bunch of reasons. One is because I don't feel in any sense that I have any authority or expertise or that I know exactly what to do now. What I do know is that a group of young people, myself included, looked around at the world, made an analysis of what was wrong, and resisted with everything within us. I think every person and every generation has that responsibility. But I'm not anyone who could provide either a blueprint or particularly a plan. I know that in my daily work, I try to figure out how to act on behalf of justice, how to resist the kinds of anti-democratic impulses that are everywhere apparent, including the enduring stain of racism in America, including the kind of bully behavior abroad. Those things still exist, and they still fire me, motivate me, power me forward.
For 10 years, how did you support yourself? How did you avoid being identified?
For 10 years, mostly, we worked common jobs. I worked in a shipyard, which I describe in some detail. We worked as migrant workers. We worked as restaurant workers. We worked outside the kind of Social Security economy, but we worked and we survived.
Did the fact that over 10 years you weren't turned in at any point suggest to you that maybe the country wasn't as hostile as you'd once thought it was?
It suggested to me that the resistance to government policies was deeper than you could observe on the surface, that people who I knew, even deeply conservative people, had no intention of hurting me or turning me in, and their revulsion at the Vietnam War was deep enough so that they didn't want to hurt me, even if they didn't agree with what I was doing.
Early in the book, you note, among a litany of heroes, you put names like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King. Why did you not do what they did and stand trial?
Well, I think
rather than go underground.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you love about a Martin Luther King or a Dave Dellinger is their willingness to put their nonviolence to work for justice. I hear a lot of people who criticize us because they say, well, I'm nonviolent, but at the same time, you don't see that nonviolence at work. Americans are famous for loving their freedom and for being against violence, but it only works for me if they're using their freedom for some purpose. I admired King, I admired Dellinger. I also felt that there were limits to those tactics. The Vietnamese were being bombed every day. 3 million Vietnamese were killed. By 1968, the American people were against the war in Vietnam, and still it escalated, and still 1.5 million people had to die. How could we stop it? That was the question that just rang in our heads day and night. How can we stop the slaughter? And we would have done anything, and what we chose to do was inexact and imperfect, but it was what we did.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Bill Ayers, his new book is Fugitive Days.